the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Charles A. Lindbergh was the hero of 1927 when he made his solo flight across the Atlantic in the Spirit of St. Louis. In 1932, Lindbergh again was in the headlines when his infant son was kidnapped in the night. The Lindbergh baby was found dead some weeks later, although a ransom had been paid. German immigrant Bruno Richard Hauptmann was eventually executed for the crime. Jim Baum is my guest. His book, Beneath the Winter Sycamores, An Account of the Lindbergh Kidnapping, raises some shocking questions about the case. Jim Baum, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much, Gary. I appreciate it. I'm glad to be here.
So, you know, let's kind of review the basic facts of the case, and then we'll get into your book. Bruno Richard Hauptmann was executed for the crime. Mm-hmm. The prosecution claimed that he climbed up a ladder, took the baby, spent the money.
Right.
He always maintained that he was innocent, and I guess there's been a controversy ever since. Regarding his guilt or innocence, that maybe there was a rush to execute him because of the fame of Lindbergh. But you come at it from a different point of view.
Yes, I do. Hauptmann always said that he was not guilty of the crime that he was charged with, and then that implied that he was guilty of something, perhaps. But I got started on this many years ago when I lived up in Trenton, New Jersey, which was maybe 10 miles from the Lindbergh estate in Hopewell. And so I can remember going up there as a kid. And my dad had been a prison guard in 1950. At that time, they called it Trenton State Prison. And right before he was leaving, a prisoner came up to him and gave him a note. And it was a note that had three pages typewritten, poorly typewritten. But and the note had some really intimate details of what really happened, according to Bruno Richard Hauptmann. Now, this prisoner who gave the note to my dad, I found out later on, was a man named Arthur Jones. And Arthur Jones, and I also found out later on that he served on death row with Bruno Hauptmann. And apparently, according to the note, Hauptmann kind of confided in him about what exactly happened on that night in March 1, 1932. And, I wondered about it when I was a kid, and then a little bit later on, when my dad passed away, I got the note. My dad put the note in his drawer, and he left it there for, it must have been 50 years almost. And so I took the note, and I started to do some research, and I said, I'm going to try to write a book according to the note and recreate the kidnapping. Of course, there's so much information on the Lindbergh kidnapping that the more you dig, the more it seems like you fall into the hole, you know.
Now, Arthur Jones, was he executed also?
No, Arthur Jones was actually, his case came up for appeal, and he was a young black man from Newark, New Jersey, and I think that there were some charges of improper evidence against him or whatever it might have been, I'm not exactly sure, but he ended up serving a life sentence, and then he ended up at Trenton State Prison. He kind of bounced around from prison to prison, but when my dad was there, he ended up over there. And he was passing this note around, but no one wanted to hear a prisoner in somebody who had been on death row saying that he knew all about the Lindbergh kidnapping. Nobody believed him. Mm-hmm. And so I guess my dad felt the same way, and he tossed the note in the drawer, and that's where it stayed until I got it after he passed away. And as I researched it, I found that in 1976, right before Arthur Jones died, he had given an interview to a man named Jeff Newman. And Jeff Newman was a young upstart reporter for the National Enquirer, which, that was a red flag. But I looked up Newman, and I found out that Jeff Newman was an attorney up in Boston and a very successful attorney. As a matter of fact, he was one of the lead attorneys in the Boston Archdiocese case against the Catholic Church when they had all that charges of child abuse. Well, anyway, I tried to get in touch with Newman, and after a couple calls, he called me back, and he said, we need to talk. And he said he remembered speaking with Arthur Jones, and he kind of validated everything for me, because if he had said that Arthur Jones, if he didn't believe Arthur Jones, then I probably would have abandoned the whole idea. But he said he really believed that Arthur Jones was telling the truth. And Arthur Jones apparently died 13 days later or something like that of a massive cerebral hemorrhage. And he went to his death, but he got it off his chest. He wanted somebody to listen to him, and the article was printed in the National Enquirer. But as most articles in the National Enquirer, people didn't take it very serious.
But even if you take Arthur Jones seriously, how do we know that what Bruno Richard Hauptmann said had any validity? What was it about the letter that made you think that it was correct?
Well, there were some things in the letter that just sounded, well, gee, maybe it could have happened this way. There were two things that stood out in the letter. One was it took a month for Charles Lindbergh to pay the ransom money, which, you know, that was a long time. The other thing that was kind of strange was that the note said that the baby did not die from being hit in the head, or he wasn't dropped from the ladder, that he died of pneumonia. So I said, well, that's interesting. And those were two red flags, but it kind of made sense in the big picture, because that's Lindbergh was desperately trying to keep the money clean. He went back and forth with the Treasury Department, a man named Elmer Ire, about keeping the money clean. The Treasury people wanted him to mark the money. In the end, he eventually marked the money, and that's how they called him, because they were gold certificates. And the fact that the baby was not given an autopsy, a proper autopsy, they looked at the baby real quick, and on the same night they discovered it, they cremated the body, which is the best evidence in any case. So, you know, as I started to dig deeper and deeper in research, and there were some names that popped up, Arthur Jones mentioned a man named Charlie, somebody. He didn't know Charlie's last name, and I said, well, that's kind of interesting. And then I found out that Hauptmann and a buddy of his name, Isidore Fish, and this Charlie and his wife were con artists. And in New York City during the Depression, they were doing whatever they could to make money, selling phony stocks. They were selling furs. They were doing whatever they could. They were hustling people. They were even hustling their own fellow Germans. These guys were all Germans. The letter also stated that Doc Condon, who I don't know if you're familiar, Gary, but your listeners, but he was the go-between or the intermediary who met with the so-called kidnapper in the cemetery on two occasions to discuss the ransom money. So this note said that Condon was involved, that Lindbergh actually hired Condon, and Condon got the Germans, and the plan was to take the baby overseas to Germany, because the baby had some physical ailments. I found out that the baby did have physical ailments. He was suffering from rickets, which is a vitamin deficiency, but he had brittle bones, supposedly, and also he couldn't hear, according to the note. And so, well, you know, things started to make more sense as I researched it and pulled it all together. And so what I did in my book is I basically recreated the kidnapping according to the note, and I added the dialogue and the vernacular of the time and tried to make it work. So
give it a novelist's touch, so to speak.
Exactly. Sort of like In Cold Blood, where Truman Capote recreated that murder out in Kansas many years ago. So kind of, here's the thing. Most of the books on Lindbergh presented the evidence, but they never really told the story, you know?
Uh-huh.
And so I said, well, I want to write a book, but I just don't want to write another book presenting the evidence. There's so much evidence, you can get burdened down with it all. I wanted to recreate a story as to how it could have happened according to the note. And that's what I did. And so, you know, that's why it has a creative nonfiction title to it.
Yeah, well, we're talking with Jim Baum, and his book is called Beneath the Winter Sycamores, An Account of the Lindbergh Kidnapping. So you're not necessarily saying that you think this is exactly what happened, but it could be.
Well, the note, according to Arthur Jones, said that he wasn't, I mean, he said that Bruno Hauptmann told him this stuff every day in little details. They had a code that they used when they were taking a shower. They spoke in code. It was basically an alphanumeric code. A was 1 and B was 2. And Hauptmann was showing Arthur Jones how to add. Basically, Arthur Jones was semi-literate. He didn't, you know, he was a young kid. And apparently Hauptmann was trying to teach him how to add. But what he was doing, according to the note, was he was giving him information about the kidnapping. And Arthur Jones said he would take the information every day, write it down, and then tear it up and throw it away because he didn't want to be caught with it while Haltman was still alive. And I guess that was the deal that the two had made. They also passed information in books back and forth. And and on the last day before Arthur Jones was moved to another prison, he said he spoke with Bruno Richard Haltman for about 25 minutes. And in the note, he kind of goes over some of the things that Haltman told him, and that Haltman regretted spending the money, that Lindbergh told him not to spend the money, but he spent it anyway, and he was living large during the 1930s. He and his wife, they had nice clothes, they had brand new radio. At a time when most people were struggling, the Haltmans were living well, and he didn't seem to care about spending money. He didn't think he would get caught, I guess, in the big city of New York.
Well, let me ask you about a couple of things that you said.
Absolutely.
Why did Lindbergh wait a month to pay the ransom?
Because he wanted to keep it unmarked. He wanted to just pay it off without marking it.
But a month, I mean, if you're looking for your baby, it seems like a month is a long time. Why don't they just do it immediately, as soon as the ransom demand came?
Well, I mean, I think that kind of points to suspicion on Lindbergh's part. I mean, if you wanted your baby back, you would do whatever you could as fast as you could to get him. And so he told the feds that, look, I want to pay it off right away. It's my baby. I want to get him back. And they said, if you want us to help you, then you have to mark the money. And he says, I don't want to mark the money. He went back and forth. I don't want to mark the money.
Hmm.
And he didn't want to mark the money because he knew that the potential was there for somebody to get caught. And somebody would get stupid and spend the money, and then it would all go back to Lindbergh and Condon, who put this thing together.
So you're saying that Lindbergh himself was involved in the kidnapping of his child?
Absolutely.
But why? Why would he want his own son kidnapped? Because the son was deaf or had rickets, or why?
Yeah, because, well, okay, now we're going to get into another angle, but yes, he had rickets, and yes, he was, apparently he didn't hear very well. According to the note that Arthur Jones wrote, Haltman told him that the baby had not uttered a word, he had not walked. There is evidence that the baby definitely had rickets. They had something called craniotomes, which was softening in the skull, which was documented. And the other angle that I'm going to get into right now is that Charles Lindbergh was a eugenicist. And he spent a lot of time with a man named Alexis Carrel, who was a Nobel Prize-winning scientist, doctor. And he was also a well-known eugenicist. And so I believe that the two of them getting together, and for Charles Lindbergh, who became this iconic figure in American history, arguably at the time the most famous man in the world, I don't think he really wanted a son who was unable to walk, who didn't talk. And so he didn't want to kill the son. But as happened probably more than we know about in that time period, people, you know, had somebody else take care of their kids. In this case, he couldn't give his son to anybody because he was the most famous person in the world. So he had to devise a plan for somebody to raise his son. And it was a plan. The Germans had said they could get somebody over in Germany to take care of him for him. He promised them $50,000 to do it. And it all blew up when, number one, the baby died of pneumonia, and he couldn't keep the money clean.
Well, now, what about Anne Morrow Lindbergh? Was she in on it or not?
Not according to the note. The note really didn't mention Anne Morrow Lindbergh. And my feeling is that Anne Morrow Lindbergh did not have anything to do with it. And I think Anne Morrow Lindbergh probably was pretty much in awe of her husband, and I think that whatever he said was the rule. And Lindbergh controlled the entire investigation. He stonewalled the New Jersey State Police. He called all the shots. And I think Anne basically let him do it. You know, she knew that he was a great man, and I don't think she ever suspected him. At least I never was able to find any evidence that she ever suspected him of being involved in it. But she never really talked about it hardly at all. And they went on to have five more children. And so my thinking is that Anne Morrow Lindbergh probably did not have anything to do with it.
We're talking with Jim Baum, and his book is called Beneath the Winter Sycamores, An Account of the Lindbergh Kidnapping. So the evidence that you have that supports your theory that Lindbergh was involved is, in addition to this letter, the fact that it took a month to pay the ransom and that the baby was cremated immediately. That's suspicious.
Yeah, and I thought in order for me to present this as a book, I needed to do a lot of research on Charles Lindbergh's character.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you're aware of it, but a few years ago, the world found out that Charles Lindbergh had 7 additional children with 3 different women. He had this a relationship with these 2 women in Germany and then a secretary, and nobody knew about it. And he was flying around the world and doing things, and he kind of led his own life. But I went back into his childhood, and I found that he spent a lot of time alone. He spent a lot of time with playing with his guns. By the time he was 5, he had a gun. When he got to be a teenager, he was fascinated by motorcycles. And then, of course, he got into the flying thing. But when he was in the military, I found out that he had a lot of difficulty making friends, that nobody wanted to be around him. On one occasion, he took a rattlesnake and placed it in the cadet's bed. On another occasion, he replaced a friend of his drinking water in his water pitcher with kerosene. And when the guy came home after a night of reveling and having fun, because Lindbergh he didn't want to drink and he kind of frowned upon all that kind of behavior, this guy turned up the kerosene and almost killed him. And then as I continued, I found that the name for his son that he used, his term of endearment for his son was It, I-T. I thought that was kind of an odd name for a son. I have 3 sons, and, you know.
You don't call any of them It?
I don't call any of them It, you know. They're my life. I love them to death. I would never do that. And then I also found that he built a chicken wire pen in January of 1932, in January, the year the baby was kidnapped. And he put the kid out in the pen for 2 hours in a chicken wire pen all by himself, and he left him alone out there. Now, the kid at this point is 20 months old. He's a sickly little child. And he tells everybody he wants the kid to grow up strong, be strong. And to me, I thought those were red flags which indicated that Charles Lindbergh probably, I'm not going to say he was sociopathic because I don't think that. But I think he had some personality issues, personality disorder perhaps. A lot of the information I found about him, he didn't know how to make friends with people, and people didn't know how to take him, and even his wife on more than one occasion had some odd situations with him that just kind of pointed to him being a strange character. So I figured, well, if he's, you know, he could possibly pull something like this off with having a kid that he didn't want. Perhaps the kid didn't bond with him. Perhaps the kid didn't fit his what he wanted in a child. You know, he was a Swede, and he thought the Swedes, as a eugenicist, were the master group, the Northern Europeans, and this kid wasn't fitting the bill. And I think that, you know, with his personality the way it was, he thought he could pull it off.
All right. Well, let's say that that's the case, and that he didn't want his son. Couldn't he have? You know, if you say that he was able to, you know, he ran the case without an autopsy and had the baby cremated immediately and so forth. Mm-hmm. Couldn't he have, say, attracted a whole lot less attention by smothering the kid in its crib and doing the same thing?
Well, I found out, Gary, that the Lindberghs weren't the best parents. When the baby was about 6 months old, he and Ann took off on a worldwide flight. They traveled up to Greenland and then down into Northern Europe and all the way out to China. And they left the baby in the hands of the nursemaid. And so, I don't know, firstborn, 20-month-old child, I couldn't leave my child for 6 months. You know, I know times were different back then, and perhaps life amongst the aristocracy is different. I don't know. But I thought it was strange for him to do that. And I also found out that they were entertaining people all the time, and that the baby really didn't know Charles Lindbergh very well. And Anne struggled with motherhood. she got pregnant right away after the I guess the baby was fairly still, not even a year, and she got pregnant again, and she struggled with morning sickness, and I don't think that the baby really bonded with him, and perhaps not her either. So, you know, in a lot of ways, the baby was not a happy camper, to say the least.
His other children describe him as distant and unbonding?
As a matter of fact, they did. They said that, you know, he wasn't around a lot when they were growing up. But on the occasions when he came home, there was a lot of tension. That he was very bossy, and he made sure that everybody knew who he was, that he was the boss. And in my book, I refer to him often as the great aviator.
Mm-hmm.
And I think whether it was a power thing, I don't know. But I've heard that from a lot of different sources, that he just was not a very father. I mean, the father is not the right word, but he wasn't a hugs and kisses kind of guy. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, of course, he famously made his America First speeches that supported the Nazis in World
right.
War II. But I think a lot of people felt that that was a reaction to having his son kidnapped, that the country he had loved and been a hero for rewarded him with this terrible crime. But you're saying that that's just kind of the nature of the guy?
That's what I'm thinking. I know that, you know, on the day that the governor, a new governor, came into New Jersey and he said that he didn't like the way the case was handled, the trial certainly had a lot of improprieties. But on the day that the new governor said he was going to reopen the case, Lindbergh came home and told Anne, "We are going to England. We're leaving tomorrow." And he went over to England in France, and he kind of dissed the United States, if you will. He blamed the press for the intrusiveness and that he couldn't live his life anymore. I don't buy that. I think in some occasions he used the press to his own advantage. But, you know, he ended up going over to Germany in the late 30s. He met with Hermann Göring. He received their flying cross, the Nazi flying cross.
Yep.
He never returned it, never turned it back to him. So I'm thinking that I believe that he probably was somewhat anti-Semitic. And so whether that, you know, you can use an excuse that it was because of the kidnapping, I don't buy it. I think he probably was you know, some of his eugenist leanings and his anti-Semitic leanings probably were some motivation for him giving that speech.
Well, let's grant all of those things, including your thesis that he's responsible for the kidnapping of his son.
Right.
Why would Bruno Richard Hauptmann go to his death? He testified at his own trial. Why didn't he say, "I was hired by Charles Lindbergh"?
Well, that's the number one question, and I don't know the exact answer to that. I can only say, well, Lindbergh and Hauptmann had made a deal, according to the note, that when it came down that they had to mark the money, Lindbergh and Condon met with the Germans, and he said, "Look, I tried to keep the money clean. I couldn't. So whatever you do, take the money." He said, "Either bury it or burn it. And but whatever you do, don't spend it." So he made a deal with them. And then the note also said that on many occasions, probably more than three or four, or maybe about three or four occasions, the governor of New Jersey met with Hauptmann. He snuck into the prison after midnight, and he had these conversations with Hauptmann. And apparently he knew something of what was going on. And he, according to the note, promised Hauptmann that his young son, Hauptmann had a young son as well, when he was brought in, and his wife Anna would be taken care of. And, you know, perhaps there was a threat there somewhere too, I don't know. But Hauptmann, he just never said anything. He just always said, "I'm not guilty of the crime that I'm charged with." On four occasions, they marched him to the room where they had the electric chair, and then they said, "No, this is not right, this is not the night." I mean, they were trying to get him to talk, but he wouldn't do it. And I think in many ways, I don't think he thought he was really going to be electrocuted, because the four times he, you know, they were trial runs, it didn't happen. And then on the fifth try, it did happen. And, you know, it's a good question that I don't think we'll ever know the real answer on that one. I'm just thinking that perhaps that was the reason.
Well, also, there were a lot of questions brought up at the trial that have persisted over the years. Houtman was a carpenter, and yet the ladder that was recovered was this rickety,
right,
crummy little ladder. And there were high heel shoe mud prints holding the ladder or beneath the ladder, and yet no woman was ever indicted. What's all that about?
Okay, well, I've seen the ladder on many occasions and looked at it up close, and the truth is the ladder, in one sense, it is like a rickety contraption. But on the other side of the coin, not anybody could have built that ladder. So Hartman is a carpenter. While he was on the stand, attorney Wilentz asked him, "Did you build that ladder?" He said, he looked at him and he said, "I'm a carpenter." And then Wilentz got on his case a little bit about his arrogance, and then Hartman said, "That thing looks like a musical instrument." So it's kind of funny, but the ladder is made, the wood was kind of not the right wood to make a ladder with, but it was a telescoping ladder. So to put this ladder, nesting it together, just a carpenter might not have been able to do that, or just not anybody could build a ladder that way. It would require some engineering prowess. And my theory is that Lindbergh built that ladder, that he had the wood around the house in one of the wells. There's a room or a building in the back where the well was kept, and I think they probably used to keep some of the wood in there. And I believe he went up there one day and he built a ladder thinking that he could stage the kidnapping. But after he put the ladder up against the house, it either cracked and it wouldn't work. And the other thing is that the ladder only weighed 37 pounds, and the night the baby was taken on March 1st, 1932, it was extremely windy and cold. It was the darkest night of the year. There's no way that a 37-pound ladder extended out would have stayed against that house. I used to paint houses when I was a young man, when I was teaching, just to supplement my income. And I will tell you, a 37-pound ladder is not going to stay against the house in the wind. It's going to blow over. So I think that the ladder became a ruse that I believe Lindbergh built the ladder. I know he built an extension ladder, a telescoping ladder, for one of his planes, and that he had built ladders when he was a young man on the farm in Minnesota. So I don't think Hartman, as maybe arrogant or confident as he was in his ability as a carpenter, would have said that that thing was a contraption or a musical instrument if he had built it. So I think the ladder was a ruse. And when I went into the house, I was able to go inside the house and spend some time in there and look around. You go into the front of the house in the foyer, the steps are to the left. At the very top of the steps is the nursery. Whoever went in there could have been up in those steps and down in 30 seconds and out the front door. On a windy, cold night, on the other side of the house where everybody was, no one would have heard anybody go in there. And so that's the theory that I went with in the book.
Well, it is a pretty fascinating book, and I think my listeners will enjoy it. It's called Beneath the Winter Sycamores, an account of the Lindbergh kidnapping. And the author is Jim Bob.
Thank you very much, Gary, for putting me on and giving me this opportunity. I really appreciate it. I really enjoy talking to you.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll come back and see us again next week. I want to thank my guest, Jim Baum, author of Beneath the Winter Sycamores, an account of the Lindbergh kidnapping. And I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, the lovely Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.